Penguin Random House Audio presents Speech Team, a novel by Tim Murphy. Read for you by Daniel Henning. To Ellie. Mendham High Gazette, Mendham, Massachusetts, April 22, 1987. Mendham High Speech Team Warriors crush elite private school rivals in state finals. Story by Tip Murray, 87. Can we talk? To that inquiry, popularized by supremely mouthy and controversial comedienne, Ms. Joan Rivers, the answer would be a resounding yes. The last weekend in March, and a frightfully frigid one at that, the silver-tongued minions of Mendham High's speech team, under the skillful tutelage of team coach and honors English teacher Gary Gold, nabbed gold medals across several categories at the Massachusetts Speech and Debate Society finals, held at Tony Tudor-style Truscott Academy on the elbow of Cape Cod. Especially shocking was the fact that, in most categories, Team Mendham placed higher than participants from so-called elite and usually highest-scoring private schools statewide, including Truscott, the Barnes School in posh Witcham, St. George's in rustic Minlehem, and most eyebrow-raising of all, Samuel's Farm in Horsey Blandford, longtime incubator of the nation's presidents, professors, and other cultural poobahs. Among the Mendham gold wins were Hampshire College-bound Mr. Peter Stroman, in the original oratory category, for his quirkily uplifting cri de coeur, "All I Really Need to Know I Learned from Rush, the Band." University of Massachusetts Amherst-bound Miss Natalie Farb Miola, in the children's literature, fondly known as Kitty Lit, category, for her artfully bilingual rendition of the Italian youth classic La Tartaruga Pigra, The Lazy Turtle. New York University-bound Anthony Maloof, in the debate category, for robustly arguing the pro side of the question, is stress good for 80s teens? Yale University-bound Ms. Jennifer Douglas, in the oratory interpretation category, for her stirringly soulful reading of Sojourner Truth's seminal Ain't I a Woman? And finally, this writer, Bard College bound, in the poetic interpretation category, for his coolly exuberant delivery of selected sections from Walt Whitman's iconic Song of Myself. Note: news writers seldom, if ever, refer to themselves by name in their own copy. Asked to comment on his team's landslide win, the team's always, sometimes too, candid Coach Gold enthused, "We showed that, with unstinting practice and shrewd guidance, students from your average Massachusetts public school can talk circles around the state's top-ranked teams, bringing home a bevy of ribbons to grace MHS's elegantly refurbished trophy cases in the main hallway." Note: Mr. Gold signed off on this quote, fashioned by this writer. As the Mendham speech team winds down for the year, it looks eagerly toward the 1987-88 competition season, during which one is certain that Mr. Gold's straight-talk approach will once again lead the little team that could to astounding statewide vindication. Finally, before this writer decamps for the verdant expanses of the Hudson Valley, just north of the cultural hub that is New York City, he would like to express his unvarnished gratitude to his voluble confrères. Note, in case you were wondering, foreign terms are often italicized, for the opportunities afforded him by participation on the speech team. The validation and affirmation that this writer could not find on Mendham's grassy playing fields or amid its increasingly exclusive social circles, dominated as they are by the ubiquity of Ralph Lauren rugby shirts and frightfully oversized Benetton sweaters, was to be found in spades in the speech team's spirit of exactitude and solidarity. So, to reiterate the query that commenced this piece, that being, can we talk? It appears that, when it comes to the Mendham High School speech team of academic year 1986-87, the riposte would be most robustly in the affirmative. Photo caption. On the bus back from Truscott Academy, the Mendham Gabbers hold aloft their profusion of first-place ribbons. Photo courtesy, Mr. Gold. February 2013, Sarasota, Florida. On the Ringling Bridge from Longboat Key to the mainland, on the way to find Gold's house, Anthony driving the ridiculously massive Escalade he'd rented at the airport, Jennifer sitting up straight beside him in the passenger seat, Nat slouched beside me in the back, mute. I contemplated the numbing idiocy of Florida. It was a better train of thought than obsessing over what we were about to do. Additionally, it was impossible not to, watching the eternal unfurling of periwinkle sky, cyan water, green palm trees, white boxy homes. How could someone not be rendered utterly imbecilic in this land of relentless sun that bleached away critical thought, frictionless weather that made cynicism a moot point? Was this what you yearned for once you hit your 60s or 70s? To trade the cold and damp of New England, that inclemency that made you cranky and mean, but also kept you skeptical and alert, for this mindless, blank paradise? Apparently, this was what Gold had wanted. No more damp and musty herringbone overcoats, no more ugly rain boots, no more exhaling that final plume from his vintage cigarette into the frigid gunmetal air of a Reagan-era Saturday morning in January before flicking it into the slush and boarding the bus, his breath sour with carcinogens and his tongue front-loaded with corny competition day aphorisms, soon to be bestowed on us as the bus groaned its way toward the highway. This is the most mind-numbingly monotonous landscape, I said. Anthony snorted a short, nervous laugh. I'll take it over New York right now. Amen to that, followed Jennifer. I glanced at Nat beside me, rolled my eyes. I'd picked up on this dynamic the night before, this subtle alignment of Anthony and Jennifer against, or at very least in counterpoint to, Nat and me. It had class overtones. Anthony's dazzling success and Jennifer's quieter but still unambiguous good fortune lording itself subtly over my existence as a non-profit communications drone in a second-tier city, over Nat's near poverty as a small-plot farmer. Projection on my part or no, the cleft bonded me more closely to Nat. I wanted her to roll her eyes back at me, at least yield a faint conspiratorial smirk, but instead she just glanced at me, her eyes full of terror? Was that what I was seeing? I took her hand. It was shaking. Are you okay? I asked her quietly. Not so quietly, though, that Jennifer, hearing, didn't twist around in her seat with a look of concern, brow furrowed. Nat looked straight ahead. I'm fine. Only then she glanced at me. I mean, I admit it, I'm nervous, but I'm fine. Jennifer put a hand on Nat's knee. I'm nervous too, she said. It's understandable, isn't it? We're doing something kind of weird. Nat, finally laughing briefly, nodded emphatically as though she were relieved and grateful that Jennifer had spelled it out. It's really weird. And it's justified. It was Anthony, glancing at Nat in the rearview mirror. But honey, if you want to back out, there's still time. You could just wait for us at a Starbucks or something. Nat didn't answer right away, as though she were seriously considering the offer. But then, no, I don't want to back out. As soon as she said it, the tremble in her hand, still lodged in mine, intensified. I squeezed it. And then, Anthony was turning the Escalade off a shopping strip into a network of residential streets, an infinite.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?